This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, the show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with English-born director, screenwriter, and most importantly, VFX artist Paul Campion. Paul has quite the story beginning his career in illustration. He barreled headfirst into a master's degree in computer animation at Bournemouth University, and Paul then made the large jump across the pond and moved over to New Zealand. And in the process, worked on probably one of the most recognisable film fantasy franchises of all time, Lord of the Rings. Since then, he's worked on a number of projects in film, and actually in video games as well, such as Sin City, Killzone Liberation, The Chronicles of Narnia and Hugo, just to name a few, and as well in obviously the VFX artist department and the art department. While he still continues to work in the field, he's also branched out into directing and producing his own work in the horror genre, including a number of short films and his feature-length debut, The Devil's Rock. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you. That's quite an introduction.
Oh, mate, I feel like every introduction I give is always impressive as the last, but yours is something else, mate, because I can't fit the unsurmountable amount of work that you've worked on and the level of work and the level of productions that you've been involved with. Does it sometimes kind of come across as probably the weirdest sort of scenario for you looking back at your CV and seeing the names that you're attached to?
Yes and no. Part of me feels like I should have done more and I want to do more.
And where does that feeling come from? Because, like, if I look back at your, like, for example, I looked at your website the other day just to kind of get a bit more of a number on the projects that you've worked on. Some of these things are, like, probably the biggest blockbusters that have come out in the last number of years, but you still feel there's, like, another roof that you need to climb or another wall that you need to break through.
Yeah, I think it goes back to, right back to my childhood. So I knew that I wanted to work in the film industry doing, back then, special effects, probably when I was about 5 or 6 years old. So I grew up on Ray Harryhausen movies, Doctor Who. One of my earliest memories at the cinema was going to see a Planet of the Apes movie, one of the original ones. And also King Kong was on repeat when I used to go to my grandparents' house for the weekend. And I just remember seeing, just wanting to make monsters and spaceships and somehow be involved in that world. And I was reading, there used to be a magazine called Cinefex, which is like the Bible of visual effects. For years, I was reading that when I was like 14 years old or something, 13, 14 years old. So I had a very clear vision of what I wanted to do. And I just didn't really know how to achieve it. But yeah, I wanted to be a matte painter. I wanted to do special effects makeup, routine. I wanted to be building models. I wanted to kind of do concept art. I wanted to do all of it, basically.
I remember seeing reference into another interview that you did that you talked about one other significant film in your childhood, which was Jason and the Argonauts. And you said that stop motion was one of these things that always just blew your mind. Do you still feel like that sense of wonder every time you work on a project that you kind of get the impression like this is just now getting to the next level? And for other young filmmakers or other young people that are getting into the industry, do you feel like that still exists, that sense of wonder that you just can't explain how something is done?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've just finished working on the How to Train Your Dragon live action remake. And, you know, even someone who's been in the industry 20 plus years, I was just absolutely blown away by the quality of the work and just how good everything looks. And just the sheer amount of work that's gone into it is absolutely incredible. So, yeah, kind of like every now and then you just think, wow, this is just fantastic. You know, the child in you comes out and, you know, you remember why you wanted to work in this field in the first place. And child and geek as well. I mean, I'm complete genre film geek, so yeah.
The interesting thing about you is you've said there was this passion always from a very early age. You said 5 years old, and I think you even mentioned that it was a double bill of Planet of the Apes that you ended up seeing back-to-back in a film in a theatre back in the day. And so you moved through this like kind of younger years of being interested in art, looking at the idea of being into texture, doing matte, and then you kind of had this weird, interesting point where you started off in technical illustration. Was that kind of like an area where you're like trying to please the parents by doing the business side of things, and then we're eventually going to move into the full creative? Or was technical illustration kind of like the beginning stepping stones of you moving into film and kind of getting a better understanding of like how things would come together?
No, I mean, actually, when I was 16, I tried to leave school and get an apprenticeship with an architectural model making firm in London, because I loved building models. I was building models of Star Wars spaceships and creatures and all kinds of things. So I did try at age 16, to enter the industry that way as a model maker. Didn't get that. Found out I really liked the design process. I did design and technology at A-level at school, and really involved making things and designing things. And a lot of that was kind of learning technical illustration. And then I can't actually remember how I ended up in that route. I think the main thing was back then the film industry was a closed shop. So there were no adverts for working on films. There were no magazines. There was no websites. There was the internet didn't exist back then. So if you didn't know someone who was working in the film industry, you couldn't get in, basically. So I had no idea at that point how to get in. I knew I liked doing illustration. I was good at doing the kind of technical illustration. So I went to Bournemouth and Poole College of Art and Design and did 4 years of technical illustration, which was actually an amazing course because we were, again, this is pre-computers, so we were taught to draw in perfect perspective, just using your eyes, just using ellipse guides and rulers and that kind of thing. And then most people were being trained to do, back then in the UK, we had car manuals called Haynes car manuals, which had exploded illustrations of all the car parts. So we were kind of being trained to do that kind of work. And also there's a, down here in Dorset, there's a big military base where they have a lot of tanks there, and a lot of people go and work there and do these technical illustrations for tanks. And I kind of realized that I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do monsters and fantasy stuff, and I kind of started angling towards book covers, much to the annoyance of one of my lecturers, who was really, I think he was actually quite angry when I started doing, I did an illustration of a chrome robot, like Hajime Soriyama, the Japanese illustrator, holding a baby, and the baby had a little green mohawk, and he just didn't know what to make of it. And I did an illustration I had a mountain bike then that I painted with zebra stripes, but I started using fluorescent splatter all over it and kind of just going a long way away from these very, very technical, very kind of cold illustration style to something kind of a bit out there. But I kind of knew that that's where I wanted to go. And at that point, I think I had an inkling about trying to get into the film industry as an illustrator somehow.
And do you think having that kind of traditional sort of foundation really did help lead the way for where you were going to get eventually? Like, yeah, I'm guessing you would have been a little bit of the rebel in the course, but did that kind of help you kind of lead to where, as you said, it was kind of destined that you were going to end up in film anyway, but do you think that technical foundation that you started off with really kind of set the scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic foundation as an artist. I've got a couple of friends who did the same course as well, and we all agree that just being able to draw and paint anything you want without a computer is almost slightly a dying art to a certain extent. I mean, there's amazing illustrators out there, and everyone's using Photoshop and 3D now, but, you know, to actually just turn all that off and sit down and be able to draw and paint pretty much anything you want within reason with just a pencil and a paper is a fantastic grounding, really.
And are you seeing like a new younger generation of people that are trying to pick up that art? Because you did say it's a dying art, but are you still seeing the occasional inkling or little spatters of younger people that are getting into the industry that are still using that as a foundation? Or no, you're seeing it totally going digital, there's a complete shift to digital, and no one's really looking back on probably what is considered analog now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, there's like incredible concept artists out there now. You just go and look on ArtStation and just jaw drops, and then you find out they're like 22 years old or something. again, not knowing what all their background is, but I think a lot of that, just being able to paint by hand, is becoming a lost art. But if you're a commercial artist, you know, now everything you're producing has got to be digital, so it almost doesn't matter, you know, if you've got the skill set to produce the finished illustration the way the client wants, then that's all that matters, really.
And for you, Paul, because you were mentioning before that the film industry at that time was very closed door. It was who you know, not what you know. There was no websites, there was no LinkedIn job search that you could go and get yourself a wee part-time job or maybe find a wee internship. So for you, what was the entry point getting in? Because at that time, as you said, did you know anyone in the industry, or was this something that you went door knocking? Because I remember in another interview you mentioned that you inquired at Industrial Light and Magic. So, like, how did it come about that you got that first kind of in point? And was it like making coffees? Like, what was the kind of first foot in the door?
I think that was in Industrial Light and Magic when they were in California, or if they'd moved to San Francisco. So that was, you know, again, probably that was pre-CGI. They're still doing everything with blue screen and optical compositing, and maybe just an inkling of Photoshop and digital effects. I think I might have wrote to them when I was still at school, when I was like 18 years old or something. I was just desperate to get into the industry, and they did write back. I don't know where the letter is now, saying thank you very much for your interest. And I'd probably track them down, because I used to read magazines like, obviously, Cinefex, and there was Starburst as well. And I think I would have actually got their details. I would have somehow done the research and gone through directory inquiries on the telephone, when you actually had to phone someone up, and found their physical address, and I wrote to them. But I didn't get in with them then. I did have one little blast at the film industry, where I bumped into a director who was actually at the art college, and him and another director, they were also doing kind of visual effects and special effects stuff, but they were actually making films at the art college. And I found out about this and immediately got in with them and started doing some matte paintings for them. And this was matte paintings on glass as well, the only time I've ever painted on glass. And they did quite a good, the finished film, it was kind of like some astronauts or something traveling to an alien planet. And it looked great. And both of them have gone on to have really good careers now. But I bumped into one of them, and he was directing an Nintendo commercial. I bumped into him in Forbidden Planet shop in London, and he needed a design for a robot suit. It was some Nintendo commercial, and it was one of the earliest Nintendo commercials that had been done using like early visual effects. And I said, I'll design it for you. And I ended up designing this robot suit, which was then made over at Pinewood Studios. And then I went over to Pinewood Studios and started doing a little bit of design work. And I think Keane, who did Hellraiser, it was his studio, and suddenly I was in Pinewood Studios. And that was my first introduction to actually being around the film industry. And it was when they were making Batman as well, the original Batman. And I remember walking around the corner, and there was the Batmobile. I was thinking,
that's wild.
Maybe I should I take a photo and sell it to the newspapers? obviously I didn't, but you know, the thought goes through your mind that suddenly you've got access to this thing that everyone wants to know what it looks like. And I did a little bit of design work for them, and I can't remember why it didn't work out. I think I just left college, and I was living with my parents, and it was the other side of London, and I was kind of driving backwards and forwards. And yeah, so that was my first little introduction anyway to the film industry.
That's a hell of an introduction, mate, because to be fair, that's probably one of the top of the line studios to be like surrounded yourself. And at some points where you're kind of pinching yourself being like, am I really here? Like, how did I do this? Was there a bit of a moment like that, or you kind of were I deserve to be here. I know I'm meant to be here.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Because I'm sure it was Bob Keane's studio, and over in a corner there'd be the Pinhead sculpt or something, or the Chatterer or the Cenobites. So it's fantastic, but I don't think I didn't pursue it hard enough. I was suddenly where I wanted to be, and for some reason it didn't work out, and then I ended up going back to illustration again. It may be because I didn't have enough of a broad skill set. So I was just doing illustration, whereas there's also people there who could illustrate, and they could sculpt, and they could make molds, and they could paint, and they could do the whole package, which is kind of what you needed to be. Whereas I was just an illustrator. And also I was quite young and my style wasn't very refined as well. I did design, I think it was a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. There was something about, I can't remember which one it is. There's a baby in some kind of like cryogenic tube or something that he has to carry around with him. I'm sure it was Jean-Claude Van Damme. And I did design that as well. That was
And
my
you got
early
to see that reflected in film as well. So you got to see the same creation that you met. Oh, man. Does that still... Is that feeling, well, I can't imagine how it must have been when you first got to see that film and see your work in there. Do you still get that same feeling even now when you're working on a project and seeing your work displayed? Because it must be a completely different feeling, because it's an image in its own right compared to a moving, breathing item, that must be insane.
I think it's when you're seeing something that you know millions of people are also going to be watching as well and just go, I did that, just that little bit. You know, if it was a tiny bit, I still did it. So I just got to let the cat.
No, you have to let the cat out, mate. Oh my God, you can even hear him.
Hang on, I'll let him through another door. Otherwise, he'll sit there and meow at me.
You had that opportunity at Pinewood. Things didn't work out the way they did. So what was the next step for you, Paul? What happened from there? How did you then proceed to working on these other projects? Because as you said, it was a small industry in England and particularly in London. What was then your next proceeding step? What did you do? Did you kind of take stock and you're like, I need to retrain, I need to do some further work? Or were you like, where's the next option? What's the next thing that I move on to?
I think I just continued as an illustrator. And... my goal was to do, I just wanted to do fantasy and science fiction and lots of horror artwork. And I kind of went for it, trying to get book covers. I did lots of book covers, computer game covers, computer game magazine covers, a bit of advertising work. I ended up getting an agent in London. So at this point, I was still airbrush artist. So this is kind of pre-computers, so it's still just painting with a paintbrush and an airbrush, which I really miss these days. I miss the discipline of painting with paint, where you have to get it right first time. You can't make any mistakes. There's no control Z. You can't save a new version. That's the craft I think that's missing, and you probably have to go into fine art now to do that. And then Photoshop came along, and I remember buying, it wasn't a Mac, they were called Mac clones back then. There were some other companies that were making that, obviously they had the processor or the software, and it was a bit cheaper than a Mac, and I bought one of those. And I remember trying to make that transition from airbrush artwork to painting in Photoshop, and wanting to pick the computer up and throw it through the window because it was so frustrating. It's like, I can just paint this with a paintbrush or with an airbrush and I can do it, but I can't paint it in Photoshop the way I want. It's too hard and too complicated. But I persevered with that, and I started using that commercially, and then then there was a turning point. So a friend of mine, so he was another illustrator, Martin McRae, he was represented at the same illustration agency, Folio, in London. And he was really, really good. His work was just beautiful. And I went up to see Folio, and they said, oh, come upstairs and see what Martin's doing. And they'd bought Martin a Silicon Graphics Octane, which was like one of the 3D computers that we were using for 3D. He was doing, I remember it was an illustration of a lemonade bottle that was kind of warped, like it was like it, but he'd done it in 3D against a brick wall or something, and it was a commercial job. And I remember looking and thinking, oh, that's quite good, but it's like, nah, that's never going to replace 3D. That's not going to replace Photoshop. It's not going to replace traditional painting and airbrush art, because you've got to have this 30 back then it's like a £30,000 computer, and it's expensive and complicated and difficult, and no one knew how to use it, and it's like, no, it's not going to replace normal hand-painted stuff. And then I started learning 3D, and then I think I'd gone too far down the fantasy horror kind of route. So I'd worked myself into a niche. So what I wasn't getting was the high paid advertising work, which is the bread and butter work. I was so focused on all the fantasy stuff. So in terms of earning an income, I wasn't earning a huge amount of money. And then, Photoshop had come along and 3D had come along, and I'd seen what Martin was doing. And then Obviously, Jurassic Park, I think, had probably come out at that point. When was that, 1996?
Yeah, I believe 97? So. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe, I can't remember when Starship Troopers came out as well. And what had happened was in Cinefax magazine, which I'd been subscribing to by that point for years, they started having adverts for jobs. And it's like, oh, there's a company that are actually advertising for artists, even if it's in California. It might be an Industrial Light and Magic or Tippett Studio or Digital Domain. It's like, oh my God, there's suddenly a contact and a person and a job. And a way to get into the industry. So I decided, you know what, all I want to do is work in the film industry. I'm going to retrain. Now is the point. It's kind of like now or never. I've been an illustrator for 10 years, and it turned out that there was a 3D animation course in Bournemouth, at Bournemouth University, which is next to the art college. So I enrolled in that, got on it, with the intention of being an animator. So I thought, right, done with the illustration. I can design creatures, but I actually want to go back to the kind of Ray Harryhausen and Willis O'Brien roots and animate creatures. And I got on that course, and then I realized that I think there was about 60 of us on the course, split into various disciplines. Some were doing 2D compositing, some were doing kind of games programming, and the rest were kind of doing animation. And I realized everyone doing animation wanted to be an animator. That was quite a lot of competition,
of course,
at the end of the course, and quite a few of them had just done a 3-year degree course, so they'd had 3 years of learning animation, and now they had a year on the master's degree to kind of hone those skills. Whereas I was coming in, I'd never actually done any animation apart from one stop motion animation that I shot on 8mm film when I was about 10 years old. Realized I'm not going to be able to compete with these guys when I come out of here. And it's like, I'm 30 years old at this point. I've been working for 10 years. I don't want to go in as a junior. I don't want to go in as a runner, making teams for the next 2 years. I want to go in at a mid-level. But what I'd found with the work that I've been doing in 3D and Photoshop, I knew how to model. I was quite good at modeling and lighting and texture painting, because the illustration led naturally into texture painting. And no one on the course wanted to do texture painting. Everyone hated it. It was you know, it's another thing you've got to learn. And so I was the only one that concentrated on texture painting. And I started learning I got the course to get me some very early 3D paint software. I can't remember what it's called, and started learning that. And also because I had a lot of knowledge about visual effects at this point, and I realized, okay, I need to have a clear goal here, and I wanted to do matte painting and environments, and then I started learning to texture paint creatures as well. And that was a kind of like a turning point.
And like a light bulb moment, because at that point you could have done one of two things: just commit and double commit to animation with the possibility of you competing with 60 other people, as you said, who are doing the same thing, but you already had that established goal, and you were like, no, you know what, I already know how to do this. I already know I'm good at it. I can double down on it and know that I can really carve out a wee, like, nice part of the industry for myself. And I guess that's where that's led to you having such a successful career, because of the fact that you've managed to double down on it. Was there any point where you were like, does this industry exist? Does this part exist? Because was it well known to have, like, an exclusive matte painter at that point? Or was it really a massive career that a lot of people were following?
I mean, I'd been living and breathing visual effects for years, so I knew all about matte painting. I knew at that point texture painting, modeling, particularly the matte painting, digital environments. I can't remember if The Fifth Element had come out at that point as well, and that was a big turning point in visual effects with the digital environments. So I understood how it was all put together, and even using the traditional matte painting techniques where you're painting something in the background, the foreground's going to be 3D. So for my master's degree, I did a shot of a single shot of a panning shot across a city that was based on Dan Dare comics.
Nice.
So we had that kind of really nice stylized feel to it. You had the Dan Dare comics, so you didn't have to design it. You just had to take those designs and basically art direct it and turn them into 3D. And I got a little team together for that project, and we just did this 10-second shot. And the interesting thing is, a lot of the other people, they were going down the filmmaking Pixar route, and they were trying to make short films. And you think the industry doesn't want I mean, it does want directors, but the industry needs people who specialize. They want a model maker, they want a texture painter, they want a compositor, they want an animator. They don't want someone who's written and directed a short film made by other students, unless it's phenomenal. And a lot of people put a lot of energy into those short films, but they weren't directors and they weren't writers. And I realized, no, I need to do shots. That's what the industry works on. That's how I'm going to get a job. I need to work on shots. So we did that one Dan Dare shot as part of my master's degree project. And then I only did, I think, one other project, which was someone else proposed this, which was a live action shot of a man pulling his face off, and inside his head is the Terminator 2
robot.
Yeah. Which then opens up to reveal the Pink Panther.
I love the creativity. That must have been wild for you guys, being able to like imagine these sorts of things and being like, we can totally put this together.
Yeah. And it was like, yeah, I've got to work on that as well. Because conceptually it was fantastic and it was one shot. I know how to do this. I know how we can pull it off. And I worked out how to do the face pulling using a mask. So we got a mask, and if you do this, oh, you can't see it. Well, what I'm doing with my arm is I'm grabbing the bottom of my chin and pulling my hand up as if I'm pulling my face off. That then creates a natural wipe. If you've got a mask underneath your hand, you'll then see the mask. And then behind that, you can then put the CG robot head in.
So like rotoscoping or compositing almost, like, putting something over top. Oh, that's incredible. Yeah. And that's the sort of things that I'm guessing, as you said, if you're specializing, this is what people want to hear. They want to think about the creativity of the method and things like that. And I remember you mentioning as well in an interview you did talking about Devil's Rock, which we'll get to soon. You mentioned the fact that people seem to sometimes forget that when you're working in this industry, you are a cog in a bigger project. And is that kind of the thought that you said before, when you're like, people were trying to be directors all the time, people were trying to create their own ideas, but they weren't thinking about what the industry is looking for, which is you being like the most valuable part of this much larger picture? And is that kind of something that you've always tried to maintain throughout your career, being like, I know where my place is in the industry, but I know I'm going to do a damn good job of it? Is that kind of like a part of the kind of industry as well, do you feel?
Yeah, definitely. I've kind of tried to diversify, but I kind of always end up coming back to what I'm good at. I think there's other things that I'm good at, but they're very highly competitive, and it's quite difficult to make that transition, especially for me, because I've been freelance for a long time. So I'm kind of hopping from job to job, whereas if you're in a big company, then there's more opportunity to move sideways into something. Some other jobs that I would really like to do, but I'm also aware that it's quite difficult to transition sideways, and that sometimes it's easier just to stay in my little lane and do what I do. But yeah, so going back to the master's degree, yeah, so we did that. So I modelled the Terminator head because I wanted to learn modelling. And it was even built in a way that when it moved, all the pistons moved and everything was kind of automatic. And it was quite a sophisticated shot. And we did a bit of research as well about people pulling their faces off, and it worked really, really well. And in fact, the guy who composited that, Matt Holland, we've been friends for years now, and he lives in Wellington, and he also did the compositing on the Dan Dare shot. And another friend, Hilary Yeo, he helped do modeling and texturing on the Dan Dare shot, and he ended up coming to Weta. Well, they both went to Weta, so we all kind of like followed the same route.
And I think that's probably a good transition, since we're touching on Weta, because you've done this master's degree at Bournemouth, and now you're probably thinking, where to next? At what point in the road did New Zealand become the option? Because I think, as we talked off mic, how did it come about that you're in this emerging film industry in the UK, which I know during the like 90s, early 2000s, it was still quite small, but it was starting to pick up some steam in relation to like the Hollywood style film productions. But at what point did you think, oh, I'll go to New Zealand? How did that even come about, and what made you even think, like, we'll go to Wellington?
Well, yeah, so there's a whole series of events that led to that. Firstly, I've been reading Cinefex magazine, and I think they started, I don't know if they started advertising for visual effects artists, or I'd heard on Lord of the Rings, or I'd read that they were making Lord of the Rings. And by this time, we had the internet as well. Like 5 years before, we didn't have the internet. Suddenly had the internet and you could follow what was happening. And oh my gosh, they're making Lord of the Rings in New Zealand. My favourite books, I've read them twice. I told everyone on the course, I'm going to go and work on that. Had no idea how I was going to pull it off. It's like, you know, possibly one of the... It could be as big as Star Wars. I'm going to go and work on that. I have no idea how. And I think at the same time, I saw an advert in Cinefex, possibly for Starship Troopers as well. It's like they're advertising for texture painters. And it's like, should I go for that? It's like, oh, I've got an industry experience. Then at the same time on the master's degree course, we had industry guests come down and talk to us. And we had people from ILM and Framestore and all these big companies. And one of the people who came to talk to us was a guy called Mike Milne, who's actually, he's sadly passed away last year. But he was, I think, one of the founding kind of members of Framestore. He helped set that company up. And he was the person that was responsible for a TV series called Walking with Dinosaurs.
Oof, good one. Very good one. I remember that growing up. What a fantastic series.
Yeah, and so he came down and talked to us and was talking about Walking with Dinosaurs and how... So what people don't know in Jurassic Park, there's only 6 minutes of CGI dinosaurs. You think you're watching a 2.5-hour movie about dinosaurs. There's only 6 minutes of CGI dinosaurs in the whole film.
That's insane. I never thought of that.
There's a lot of practical dinosaurs. But if in terms of the whole film, there's probably only like 15 minutes of dinosaurs in the whole thing. And that's the genius of Steven Spielberg, because you think you're watching people reacting to dinosaurs, and you are watching people reacting to dinosaurs, but you're not seeing the dinosaurs, you're seeing their reaction. So there's only about 6 minutes of CGI dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. And then Mike Milne came along with Framestore and Walking with Dinosaurs, and they were doing 45-minute episodes with all dinosaurs.
Which is insanity when you think about the workload, the sheer amount of production value that went into that.
And it's the cost. So,
yeah.
I don't know, you know, Jurassic Park, you know, let's just say they spent $50 million on the dinosaurs. Just pluck that figure out, you know, top of my head. Walking with Dinosaurs, it would have been about $5 million, 45 minutes.
That's insane. Absolutely insane.
So they were, you know, at that point, what they were doing was absolutely groundbreaking. And everybody, they were the like hottest company in the industry at the moment. And I was like, oh my God, how the Framestore managed to pull this off. I wanted to make dinosaurs since I was a child as well. It goes back to the Ray Harryhausen and Willis O'Brien. In fact, my mum used to take me to the Natural History Museum in London. And she took me to a lecture on dinosaurs, and I think she said I was like 4 years old. And they weren't going to let me in. I said, no, he's too young. He's just going to be disruptive. And she said, no, it'll be fine, it'll be quiet. And I do remember sitting there and watching, it would have been an early Willis O'Brien dinosaur stop motion animation, and just being enamored with it. So, I loved dinosaurs as a kid. And so I got Mike Milne's business card and kept in contact with him. And I thought, maybe that's my way into the industry. At this point, I thought, Lord of the Rings, kind of pie in the sky dream, but Framestore, maybe that's achievable. And then as soon as we finished the course, I realized that I needed to get a job straight away, because what I didn't want to be was a graduate with no experience. So I took the first job I could get. And again, this is due to my age. I was in my early, I think I was 30 at this point. So I took the first job I could get, which is working for Lego Media, working on a Lego game, driving game. I can't remember which one it was, as a modeler. And I was modeling Lego pieces, which are square or round. It's like not quite the career path you're hoping for, but suddenly I was working professionally. I was learning. It was a very, very small team, but it was really fun. It wasn't quite what I wanted to do. But so as soon as I got that job, I knew now I'm not an ex-graduate with no experience. Now I'm a working professional with a proper job on my CV. So I immediately then applied to Framestore with Mike Milne, who then hired me. And I was the first person. I was coming in at the end of Walking with Dinosaurs, so they had a real tight team. And I came in at the end of that, and I was started working on, they did a one-off called The Ballad of Big Al. So this was when it was still the normal dinosaurs before they went to the next, what's the right word for it? The next era, when you've got mammoths and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So this was still kind of like Tyrannosaurus Rexes and Diplodocus and all those kind of dinosaurs.
Incredible.
And I was, so they brought me on as a modeler and texture painter. So I learned how they were building the models, which was really interesting, using sculptures, which they scanned, and displacement maps, kind of half modeled one dinosaur. And I did a side view, because back then they didn't have any 3D paint software the way we have now, or they got their own proprietary system, which is very simple. When you got your model, you did a very high res render of it, and then you painted, designed your skin textures in Photoshop just as a flat side view, and then that was projected.
Oh, interesting.
On. It's kind of, I mean, it's the same way that you do it in 3D software, but you do one side projection and then you do another projection for the top where it's all smeared, and you kind of very basic, but it worked really.
Yeah, it was
well.
Like the starting point of being able to do 3D modeling and paint textures in a way that, like, yeah, previously you wouldn't have been able to do. That's incredible.
Yeah. And they'd already done the whole of the first season of Walking with Dinosaurs like that, so, you know, the technique worked. It was simple but very, very effective, and it didn't use any expensive proprietary software. It had all been built in-house. So I learned from Mike Milne. I remember I was trying to paint some textures, and I was actually painting it by hand, and he was like, no, you've got to get photos. We're doing photoreal. You can't paint something photoreal by hand, because the human brain always, we're not very good at doing random textures and things. So just go out and take photos, use photos, and taught me to use photos of elephant skin, which is really doubles up really well for dinosaurs, and in fact that's actually what I used to paint the Balrog as well. And then there was another guy, Darren Hawley, he was their kind of lead texture painter, so I learned a bit from him. But then while I was working on that, so I'd only been there about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then I saw they were advertising for a texture painter job at Weta on Lord of the Rings, and I thought, yeah, I've got to go for it. And I was also really sneaky, because I knew at that point I'd only just started working at Framestore, but I was now at Framestore on Walking with Dinosaurs, which is like the hottest show in the world at that point. That was
on my scary? Was it scary thinking, like, I have this big opportunity on the horizon, so many things could happen, I've got this also incredible thing coming up. Like, what was going through your mind at that point? Because that must have been a really tough decision to be like, I've got a good gig where I am. Am I really going to take this risk and move to New Zealand? Like, what was going through your head at that time?
Yeah, exactly that. I've wanted to make dinosaurs since I was a kid. I'm in. I'm there. I kind of, like, hit the big time here. Well, not the big time, hit the, little gold mine, essentially. And this could be a fantastic place to stay and learn and progress. But it's Lord of the Rings.
it's
Lord of the Rings. So I applied, and I had an interview a week later on the phone. And then a week after that, they offered me the job.
Do you remember where you were?
I was at work, yeah, when the email came through. And yeah, it was exactly like you said. It's like, do I stay here with this incredible opportunity at Framestore and Walking with Dinosaurs, or do I jump ship and go and work on Lord of the Rings? And it's like, I've got to go to Lord of the Rings. Also, I'm a big water sports guy. I love, back then it was windsurfing and surfing, and New Zealand was beckoning in terms of water sports and wanting to move somewhere a little bit warmer.
So a match made in heaven then. It was almost like it was meant to be. It was always meant to
be. Yeah, and then it turns out the guy that I was sitting next to, Carlos Rosas, at Framestore, he was one of the lead animators. And I told him, because we were both like following all the production, and, you know, every time a picture would pop up looking at it. And I said, I've just been offered a job. And he's like, so have I. And I'm going in to tell Mike Milne that I'm quitting, like, tomorrow. And I'm like, oh, this isn't going to go down very well.
So you're like, who's going to race to the office first? Who's going to get him first?
And Mike sat, his office was right behind us as well. So he just went in and handed his notice in and came out. And so I wasn't very happy. And I'm like, shit, I can't tell him now that I'm quitting. But I've only been here like 5 weeks or something, and I'm the first person he's hired for about a year and a half or something. It's a really privileged position, and, you know, I was very, very grateful to get it. And I went in, and he obviously wasn't too happy, and a few other people there were like, why are you quitting? Like, you just landed this job, and I'm like, actually, I'm 30 years old. I'm not coming in as a junior. I'm, you know, I kind of aim to come in as an intermediate, and I've got this opportunity. I've got to take it. So yeah, I think I worked for like another 4 or 5 months, painted half a dinosaur, and then left to go to Weta. And I kept in contact with Mike Mellon, and actually years later, he came down to New Zealand and I showed him around Weta Digital, and I also showed him around Weta Workshop as well, which is where all the really cool stuff is, costumes, props and everything. And he did say if he'd had the opportunity, he would have loved to have worked on it as well. So he did forgive me.
There was a sense of completion by giving him the wee tour and being like, mate, like I would have stayed, but who would have said no to that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, that's so beautiful. And I kind of like the fact that you did get to kind of have that closure before he passed away, because, yeah, it sounds like he was very influential on the whole industry, and being able to kind of have that moment must have been lovely. And
yeah,
in terms of moving from UK to New Zealand, it's a big leap. What was it like for you moving into Weta and working on Lord of the Rings? How was the kind of the environment? Because I'm guessing Weta was still kind of in its infancy at that point. What was it kind of like? Was it very hard driven? Were the team there quite like chill? Kind of what was the scenario when you're working with this team? Because it is quite a big production, but New Zealand's film industry was very tiny at that point.
Yeah. Well, Weta was very tiny at that point. I think by the end of the first film, there was only 250 of us working on the visual effects. And back then, it was kind of crazy. It was by the seat of your pants, making stuff up as we were going along. So what they did, they didn't hire the best people in the world because they couldn't really afford them. And at that point, the industry was so small, like that, you know, if you were like flame operator or something, you were making a huge amount of money. So they stepped down to the upcoming artists, and they hired people that were passionate about Lord of the Rings. So everyone was there because it was Lord of the Rings, and everyone wanted to do an amazing job. And when I got there, I was really lucky. I ended up in a room with two lovely people, Mel James and Paul McGuinness. So she was another texture painter, so she kind of like helped me learn the pipeline. And then Paul McGuinness, who was a shader writer as well. So I had a lot of help from them. But the one thing you could do was go onto the system, and now it would be like something like ShotGrid or F-Track, and just look at all the work that had been done, and everything was available. So I just spent the first few weeks with my jaw kind of on my desk, like, oh, there's Gimli's armor, or there's Gimli's axe, or there's Legolas's bow, and there'd be the real version, and then there'd be the CG version on a turntable, and you're looking at it going, holy crap, it's incredible. Partially the design, because the design that came out from Weta Workshop and Richard Taylor was obviously just, you know, absolutely incredible, the work that they did in defining all those different races and the detail that went into it. But then you're looking at the CG stuff and just going, I can't tell which one's real and which one's CG. It was absolutely incredible. And at the same time, they had dailies in the evening at like 6 p.m. or something after we finished work. Not dailies, rushes. So you were seeing the actual live action rushes coming through. So I went and watched those every day for like 6 months, and just saw as they were kind of finishing the tail end of the filming, which was absolutely incredible. And you just, you know, when you saw it for the first time and you were a fan, and like, they got it right.
Yeah, they've done it a good service, they've done a solid, you know it's going to be something good. And did you know from that immediate standpoint when you're watching the rushes, you're like, this is going to be a behemoth project? Because I think you've mentioned as well in a previous chat that you were always interested in contributing to like the more iconic characters like the Balrog and Shelob, and you actually had a Balrog yourself, which was from a Dungeons & Dragons game, if I'm not mistaken. You used to have a Balrog on your desk, is that correct? Was it kind of like, this is kind of like every boy's dream, you're getting to work on like the ultimate fantasy sort of book that has ever come out, and now you're getting to create all these wonderful characters. Like, how did you put it into words when you were telling friends or family at home, like, I finally got into my dream space?
Well, yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, so I I'd read Lord of the Rings twice by that point. I was into Dungeons & Dragons when I was younger. I used to collect all the lead figures and love painting them. And one of my favourites, the characters, or creatures from the books and that whole sequence was the Balrog. And I had a little Games Workshop lead figure that I'd painted. And I brought that with me and I put it on my desk. And then when I got there, I said, I'd like to paint the Balrog, please. They went, okay. And then suddenly I opened up Maya. Was it Maya or was it? What was the other one? I think it was Maya. Yeah, no, it was Maya at that point. It was another, I can't remember the other 3D software. But anyway, I opened up Maya and there's the Balrog model. And like, okay, I've got the biggest creature possibly in the whole movies. And I don't actually know what I'm doing because I kind of blagged my way here. I only painted half a dinosaur at Framestore. I didn't actually finish a whole dinosaur or even see it moving and know that the textures are working properly. And I've got the Balrog now. So I need to kind of figure out how I'm going to do this without anyone knowing that I don't actually know what I'm doing. But luckily, I'd learned just enough from Darren Hawley and Mike Milne and Framestore. And I just applied the same technique. So I did a side render of it and I did a high-res render and I took that into Photoshop and then I started painting a side view. And I went back to what Mike Milne taught me. It's like, don't paint it by hand at all. I did do a little bit of hand painting, which I'll get to. And I used elephant skin textures. And that is pretty much what forms the basis of the whole Balrog skin. And then at that point, we had paint software called Studio Paint. So you could rotate the model and paint a bit, rotate the model and paint a bit more. And I worked late as well because the manuals weren't online or we had physical manuals, loads and loads of books that I'm like reading through, going, how does Studio Paint work, and staying late and just trying to learn as much as I could do the best job I could. And Weta Workshop, they built maquettes as well, so I asked for one of them and I had it was kind of like easily 6 foot, 2 meters long maquette hung up on the wall and in front of my opposite my desk so I could study that because the design was just absolutely incredible. So it was trying to take what they'd done and then translate that into the CG version. And I had a really good shader writer that I worked with, Rob Schreider. So he was doing putting the shaders together and where the kind of cracks open up and the fire comes out. And we worked on that for 6 months, I think.
Yeah, because that was actually going to be my next question, because we're talking about creating this creature, but in terms of timescale, 6 months. And by that point as well, because you're an artist, did you ever feel like it was completed? Like now, when you look back at the film, is there still points where you're like, oh, I really would have loved to have done this? Or was it a case of like, sometimes when you're working on a project of that size, you have to be kind of like happy with what you've got at a certain point?
No, we kept on working on it until everyone was happy with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for the displacement maps, I actually, on his skin, did paint those by hand.
Yeah, you were mentioning this. So why did you decide to paint that with hand?
I think because I probably started off with the color maps for the skin. But there were so many different varieties of skin on his arms and his back, and his stomach was slightly different. Stomach was supposed to be a little bit softer, and then his legs, and then his feet were kind of almost like eagle talons to a certain extent. So there was so much variety. And I needed to control the height of the displacement as well. So I just painted it by hand and then we'd do a render and test it. And I'd go in and like that bit needs to be sticking out a bit more and that bit needs to be going in a bit more there. Painted all of the displacement maps by hand. And I think by the end of it, there was something like 15 layers of textures on that, all controlling different things. And I knew we had that one shot where there's a close-up shot where it roars into the camera, his mouth.
Yeah, opening of the mouth. Yeah.
Yeah, so I probably would have spent about a week just painting the inside of the mouth because I knew we were going to be seeing inside his mouth and that's got to look good. And I remember there's another shot where the foot comes down really close to camera as well and we had to, it's like there's not enough detail, we had to go back and put more detail into the foot. And we just kept on until it was as perfect as we thought it could be and everyone else was happy with it and Peter Jackson was happy with it. So yeah, I don't think at any point we were, you've got to stop working on this or there isn't enough time. It was like, make it, get good. Don't cut it up.
It was so groundbreaking as a film, and the amount of detail, as you said, and the way that you're describing the mouth itself was something that you painstakingly worked on. So I can completely understand like your viewpoint, and also from the standpoint as well that you guys were a very small production by traditional standards now, so that you guys were always going to be going the extra mile. And I'll pivot forward a little bit further on, because after Lord of the Rings, you worked on a pretty diverse range of films, like Sin City, X-Men: The Last Stand. And how did you adapt your artistic styles to these other films? Because you've told me your main focus was always fantasy and horror. How did you adapt to maybe other visual worlds and areas that maybe needed a different kind of flair?
I think you're a working professional, and you have to do what's asked of you. That's someone else is designed it. It's done the art direction, concept art, cinematography, all the design. Your job is to help turn all those visuals into the finished product on film. Yeah, it's kind of like it's part of the job. You go into any kind of job knowing that you're providing a service, and you're there to kind of solve problems, basically. How do you create the Balrog? How do you create Los Angeles in Constantine that's been turned into hell? That's what you're there to do, whatever needs to be done. And whoever is supervising you wants it done.
Because in that respect as well, like I said, main love has always been fantasy and horror. But then we're talking about other films that you've worked on, which you've been working on projects, which it needs a sense of grounding because the places are real. There are locations that take place in a certain time. I believe you worked on Legend as well, where you had to recreate Soho and the vibe of Soho back in that time. In terms of like working on projects like that, do you think there's some unique challenges or things that like you find are a little bit more difficult when you're working in a sort of time period or a location that is real, that differs from fantasy?
Yeah, they're both got their challenges. I love doing research. I really enjoy working on the historical projects. I'm very detail oriented. So anything to do with taking a modern city, like I said, like Legend, where they shot that. I think they shot it in the East End, and then we had to make it look like Soho.
Yeah.
Yeah, and kind of like working out, okay, do I need to remove that window frame? Is that window frame period correct, or what do I need to replace it with? And yeah, I just find that whole side of things fascinating. And conversely, if you're doing a big science fiction show, then you've still got to ground it in reality somehow. But in the end, that's the thing, you're there to make it look good.
Yeah, in the same respect, as you said, you have to ground it in its own reality. So understanding what are the rules of this fantasy world, does this make sense in this sort of like time and period and setting? So yeah, I love that. And we'll pivot a bit further forward as well and talk about your work then going into directing short films and features. So not only do you do this work behind the scenes, but you've also been right behind the camera, being the leading project manager on some pretty awesome projects. So what, like, how did that come about? Because for many people that work behind the scenes and visual effects and other things like that, they never get behind or get into the directing chair. So what kind of inspired you to get into the directing chair?
I think probably because I was working on projects that had been designed by other people. And yeah, there was probably a drive to be creative in myself. And I'd been an illustrator, and I had the opportunity to have a little bit more input into some things. I mean, some things like book covers, that you might get a very tight brief, but other times they just give you the book, come up with an idea for the cover. So I'd had the opportunity to have a certain amount of creative freedom. And I think I just wanted to try that. And it was back when there was the 48-hour film festival just started in New Zealand, and I kind of got involved in that. Yeah, I think I just wanted to be a little bit more involved and step away from the computer and get a bit more hands-on. Did some 48-hour films. I was kind of involved in making some of them. I directed one, which was terrible. They involved two people, a couple, I can't remember, I think they'd been out on a date or something, and then the date had gone a bit pear-shaped, and they woke up handcuffed to each other. It was weird. It was like, it wasn't very good. It wasn't my best work as a director. But we did actually use the actress. She actually ended up at the end of Devil's Rock. I got involved in the 48 Hour Film Festival, and then one of the ideas that we came up with was possessed hamsters, and we didn't use it to make an entry into the 48 Hour competition, but I thought that's quite a good idea that we've got. And then I worked with the writers and kind of ran with it and came up with a short story called Night of the Hell Hamsters about possessed demonic zombie hamsters. And then ended up back in the UK and met a producer, Elizabeth Pinto, and we kind of ended up putting it together, and it was quite a good little fun gory short horror film involving hamster puppets and all kinds. It was very much in the spirit of kind of early Peter Jackson.
Love it. And do you, because I think this is the thing about horror films now compared to the horror films that we're going to go into later, discussing some of the other work that you have. Do you feel like horror has sometimes taken a bit of the fun out of horror itself? Because now we have a lot of horror which is either extremely gory for the sake of being gore, like body gore, and not necessarily the fun kind of goofy side of things, which horror can sometimes have as well. Do you feel like that's kind of a missing part, the fun that has come out of horror?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I miss... And I kind of grew up with horror films in the 80s and I miss it when it was all a bit over the top and silly and ridiculous. And it's just, some of them just a bit grim sometimes, a bit too grim and a bit too nasty. And I know there's, there's an audience for everything. And there's some films, I think that's really grim and nasty, and then they make huge amounts of money, and it's like, am I completely off track here? I don't know, maybe it was a generational thing of its time, but yeah, I do kind of miss the kind of slightly more silly, more fun stuff,
particularly almost campy, like Nightmare on Elm Street, sort of like so over the top that it's you can't help but almost laugh but love it at the same time. There still is the horror, the scare element, but it's so over the top that you can't help but find it a little bit funny. Yeah,
and Dusk Till Dawn, even Black Sheep, it's just got a sense of fun. I do feel, I prefer horror films where if it's, in terms of like the level of gore and violence, if it's monsters and creatures and something fantastic, you can go completely over the top and ridiculous, and it doesn't matter so much. But when it's just people being really brutal to other people in a very kind of serious non-fantasy way, then kind of not so keen on those kind of movies these days.
And moving into talking about movies, we can't not talk about The Devil's Rock, which was your debut feature. And you've worked on these big budget films yourself, working behind the scenes. How was it to be at the helm of your own film, and as an experience in its own right, how was it? Because you funded this film yourself. This wasn't some like film where you had the big studio money. You had to make it work based on your budget. How did you find the experience working on The Devil's Rock?
It was exhilarating, terrifying, and exhausting all at the same time, and a huge learning experience. So I put that together. I've been trying to get various feature films off the ground. Got fed up, not being able to raise any funding, and thought, okay, how can I make a film with three people in a room, and can I remortgage my house? Because by that time I bought a house in New Zealand. Can I remortgage my house and take a risk, and can we just make it for like $150,000 New Zealand dollars? Met up with a producer, Leanne Saunders, and she said, let's take it to the New Zealand Film Commission. They put in, they put in another $400,000, so $550,000, which is, that's about the catering budget for Avatar. And and just suddenly the New Zealand Film Commission said, yes, we're going to help fund this little horror film that's not really got much New Zealand content, and we think the script could be better, but here's the money anyway, off you go.
Incredible.
Yeah. So in terms of the pre-production, I really enjoyed that because that was my thing in terms of world building, and I could bring all, going back to being an illustrator, I could illustrate what the demon looked like. And I actually went to the Channel Islands off the coast of France, and that's what inspired the project, and actually visited the real German bunkers and took loads of reference, and I'd loved the whole world building and kind of art direction and that area. But actually shooting it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. My first day on set, so we were in the set, all the crew were standing around. One of the first actor is up to do his scene, and Rob Marsh, who was the director of photography, no, not Rob Marsh, it was the first AD. He's like, right, Paul, how do you want to shoot this? And I'm looking around, all these people, I'm in the set, and we've built the set, and I'm thinking, you've pulled this together. You've got all these people. All these people are here who hopefully believe in you. Everyone was working on very, very low wage as well. Everyone was like on a flat rate. From the DOP was on the same rate as the runners. So everyone was like, they're not there for the money. They're there to support the project. And I had this moment of, you wanted this, you've got it, but I don't know what to do.
Like an oh shit moment. Like you're like, I'm the one that's saying action. I'm the one that's saying cut. They're listening to me. Was there a little bit of that? Yeah,
and there's 20 people standing around waiting for you to say something. And I had to, in my head, go, you wanted it, you got it, get on with it. And it's like flicking a switch, go, be the director. And it's like, okay, so he's going to walk in here and he's going to walk over there and we're going to do coverage here, one camera here, maybe a close-up here, and then he's going to walk over there. And everyone went, yep, great, and got on with it. Because that's what they wanted. They want the director to direct. I don't want the director to stand there and just go, I don't know what I'm doing. And I also, it goes back to when I made a short film, Eel Girl, which is quite technically complicated. And it was made at Weta Workshop. We had Richard Bluck, who had just come off, what did he come off? King Kong, The Lord of the Rings? Possibly King Kong. Second unit director of Lord of the Rings, King Kong, Avatar. So, you know, got a bit of kudos. He brought his crew along to make Eel Girl. And they were like, what are we doing making this tiny little weird short film? But Richard Taylor, who ran Weta Workshop, had supported us. And after we'd shot that, he came up to me and said, I thought you did a really good job, because I've been on films where after the third day, the director is sitting in a corner and the first assistant director and the director of photography are directing the film because the director's lost control. And he said, no, you didn't lose control at any point during that film. And that went through my head on that first day, getting that first shot. It's like, I have to stay in control. Even if it's a semblance of being in control on the outside, as long as people think you know what you're doing and you are making clear decisions, yeah, then it'll move forward really well.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of when you finally finished the film, because it must have been, I think from memory, it was a 5-week production. Is that correct? You had 5 short weeks? No, it was even shorter than that.
We shot it in
15 days. You had 15 days to get that all together, pull it all together as a director, lead this team, a bit of post as well. How was it after that whole process? How long was the process of you putting together this independent film?
So I came up with the idea in February. I came up with the idea of the demon and the book, and the German bunker and the soldier coming in and the demon looking like his ex-wife and all that kind of stuff. Then got together with Paul Finch, who was the co-writer, and we'd been trying to come up with scripts. And we kind of like, he wrote the first draft of the script, and then we continued fleshing it out. I think we went into production in August, and then obviously, it was a 15-day shoot. And then, post-production, I think we wrapped that around about January, maybe. So within a year. I mean, the fact that it was like 6 months between me coming up with the idea and then us actually being on set shooting was pretty crazy. Never going to happen again.
And upon release, because I think this must be always the most terrifying thing, is releasing the film as well. Did you feel quite vulnerable in a sense? Because you've put this together, this project that you've worked together with a very cool team of people who have all agreed to be a part of this project. How was it on release day when you first had that premiere? Like, how was it for you?
I think I was quite bullish, and I kind of got a rude awakening of how the film industry works. So looking back, it worked for some people. The horror crowd really liked it because it was trying to be intelligent and talky, and it wasn't kind of like lots of cheap jump scares. We tried to do our best with mostly practical effects and gore and kind of keep it old school. Mainstream audience didn't like it because it was too talky and there wasn't enough action, and they were expecting a bigger World War II action movie. They weren't expecting this little chamber piece. In hindsight, if I could have gone back and re-edited a few things to make it more commercial, I think I was trying to make my vision, and now it's like my vision's irrelevant. It's making a film that's commercial, because it's the film business, and you have to make a film that is going to make its money back and make money all the way through the process. So yeah, that was quite an eye-opener. And I kind of thought, that's it, I've made a feature film, you know, opportunities will come knocking. And it was not like that at all. It was pretty much, yeah, you made a film, did okay, really interested to see what you do next after you've made your second one, but we're not going to help you.
And I think one thing I wanted to touch on as well is it actually had quite a lot of success on YouTube. And I remember seeing that you were quite frustrated by the fact that these same horror fans that turned out to watch it on YouTube and other streaming services, someone has downloaded and uploaded it illegally, are probably not the same people that would have been paying to see it. Was it kind of frustrating in a way that you know there is an audience for this, but the audience just aren't willing to put their money where their mouth is? Is that kind of a frustration of the current film industry, especially independent film, where people are... like, don't want to take the risk in spending money on something?
Yeah, the piracy thing is interesting because we had people, remember someone contacted Leanne Saunders. I think she got online and asked why they were pirating, and they said, well, I didn't know about the film. I only found out about it through a pirate website, and I really like it, and now I'm going to go and buy it. So there is a flip side. We were just a victim of DVD piracy back then. So the film came out in the UK first. It was the UK company didn't do a big release. They've got their schedule. They need to bring out a horror film here and a thriller here and a kids movie here. So they bought it for a release. They released it about a month before the biggest horror film festival in the UK, Fright Fest. So we didn't play at Fright Fest. We didn't get all that horror crowd. It came out on DVD, and as soon as it came out on DVD, it was immediately pirated, and we could track. Had friends who were tracking how many copies had been pirated, and how it was just spreading out. And it was almost like a virus. It was thousands and thousands of copies, and you think, well, if everyone had just paid £1, $1, we'd have made money. And then the problem was other distributors then went, well, why should we buy the rights to this, because it's already available for free?
That's so online. Frustrating. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, well, we can't control that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you start to get an understanding of how difficult it is to actually make a film that makes money, and how you need to plan your release date and hit festivals and start to get word of mouth. But obviously, you've got to have a good film in the first place. So whether this would have made more money now that we've got more internet access and more social media and we could have built it up, I don't know. I think it probably found its audience. There's people who like it, and it was a bit of a Marmite movie.
Because the thing is, there was demand for a sequel, and this is the thing I loved looking back on through comments on The Devil's Rock, that people were saying, where's number two? When are we going to see a sequel? And I think, is that in a way, like, kind of frustrating? Because I think I saw you even said you had a concept ready for a sequel. Do you still have that back in mind, thinking, like, if I ever get the chance, I would love to do it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, the sequel's nuts. Myself and Paul Finch, the same co-writer, we thrashed it out, and it's kind of like Aliens to Alien. It involves going back to the island and bringing back Matt Sunderland as the devil. Yeah, someone goes back to the island and they've got the book. They somehow bring back the demon, who then vomits up Matt Sunderland's head that she bit off into a pool of black demon blood, and from that, Matt Sunderland rises up out of the demon blood, and he's actually, at that point, he's the devil. And there's a priest as well. There's a priest that's gone back, but the priest is actually there to summon the devil, not fight it. And it also involves an army of Nazi zombies that rise up as well. So there's, in the end, there's two battles. There's a battle going on with the devil inside the bunker, and then there's a battle going on outside with these zombies. Yeah, dead zombie Germans. Yeah, it was nuts. Very expensive to make, but it there was more demons as well. There was kind of like three. Yeah, there was a young girl demon, and then there was a kind of like an old woman as well. Yeah.
So bigger budget, bigger film, more badass going on in there. Oh, mate, it would have been incredible. And I love the fact that you've still got this concept there, that like, for whenever the opportunity arises, it's going to come. So I'm sure anyone who is a massive fan of Devil's Rock is going to be looking forward to you putting that together when the money comes through. Or, I don't know, when a lovely film commission decides to put some money where the mouth is.
Yeah. I mean, how long did it take to get Top Gun 2, mate?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. You know, there's every opportunity, Paul. Every opportunity.
And nobody cares that it was like 25, 30 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah, no one minds. Yeah. It's fine. And kind of going towards the end of chat, Paul, I want to know, you've worked on everything from these huge Hollywood productions, low-budget indie films. What do you think you've learned from navigating both ends of the spectrum? What do you think has been your major takeaway from working on both ends? And that includes being behind the scenes, directing. What do you think has been the most memorable lesson or something a mentor has taught you during this time?
I think to try and keep your enthusiasm and passion for the work, because everyone wants to make good films. Nobody tries to make a bad film. Everyone wants to do good work and wants to see a good movie up on screen and wants their work to be part of something good. Yeah, trying to keep that enthusiasm and keep doing top-notch good work, kind of regardless of the project, you know, if it's a huge $150, $200 million movie or just a small, not necessarily small, but, a TV series where the scale and scope is much smaller, but still try and keep wanting to do quality work and improving your craft.
And Paul, if people want to get in contact with you or find out a little bit more about your work or future projects, where could they go to get in contact with you?
I've got a Facebook page of sorts. Yeah, there's an email address on my website. Yeah, there's Vimeo, probably Facebook or via my website or something. That would be the easiest thing.
And the final question, is there any projects that you can tell us about that you've got coming up in the near future?
I've been obviously trying to get a feature film off the ground since The Devil's Rock. Gone through various projects which have fallen over for various reasons. Currently got a project called The Cage, which is based on a short story by an American author called Brian Keene, who I'm good friends with. And I've tried at various times to adapt some of his novels into feature films. This one was written almost like, okay, I need to write something that's five people in a room again. So it's very, hopefully very contained. We've got a wonderful producer, Jared Connon. So he was a line producer on Ty West's X and Pearl, which was shot in New Zealand. And he was previously, my brain's gone, location manager on Lord of the Rings and Mulan and huge, huge budget movies. And he's moving into producing. And also Catherine Fitzgerald, who's the executive producer, another fantastic New Zealand producer who just did The Role of Jenny Penn. Yeah, with John Lithgow. Anyway, so it's the premise is it's a pair of millennials who are disillusioned with humanity and what's happening with mankind and decide to take a group of people in a home electronics store captive. They lock them up in a security cage in the stock room where all the high stock is kept, and then take them out one by one and surgically connect them to a sacrificial altar of TVs, which they're going to use to connect to analog radio signals and summon an H.P. Lovecraftian evil god-like creature from another dimension, which is going to rule over humanity and reboot mankind.
Incredible. I love the sound of it already. I need to know more. I think that's brilliant. And Paul, I just have to say, it has been an absolute pleasure getting to speak with you, learn about your career, learn about the history of how you got into the industry, and learn about some of the new projects you've got coming up, as well as talking about some of the ones that you've done in the past. But I just have to say thank you so much for your time today, and it's been an absolute pleasure.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.